dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are a few people whose intelligence I value more than that of Hans von Spakovsky. We call him HVS around here. He is a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation these days and a former special assistant to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, and also a member of the Federal Election Commission and President Trump's unfortunately short-lived inquiry into voter fraud, topics that we're anxious to catch up with him about. But first, and most urgently, after a brief welcome, good to have you with us, Hans.
Well, Frank, thanks for inviting me back on.
Always happy to have you. The topic du jour that I wanted to get your readout on most immediately, of course, was Robert Mueller's rather peculiar press conference yesterday, and what we now see it has seemingly further catalyzed, namely an impeachment inquiry against President Trump. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, you know, what was so odd about it was that, you know, the main purpose of it was for him to say, I'm resigning and we're shutting down the office of the special counsel. He should have just said that and then sat down. But then he repeated, in essence, he didn't say anything new. He simply repeated the same things that he had said, the top line in his report. But this has been read by all of these elected officials, Democrats in Congress, as somehow spurring them to say, well, now it's for sure we need to do an impeachment. I think the whole press conference has been completely overread by those who want to do it that way, because he didn't say anything new or different than what was in the report.
Well, as a lawyer and with great familiarity with the constitutional rights of American citizens, it has been widely said, and I think rightly, that he was seemingly turning upside down the whole presumption of innocence bit with his comment to the effect that, well, just because we didn't say he had, you know, obstructed justice doesn't mean he didn't do it, or something to that effect, which is seemingly, again, gotten the Democrats supercharged in pursuing now impeachment. Is that right? Is there a larger sort of impropriety here as well?
Yes. I mean, there's no question of that. But again, you see that in the way the report was written. Again, he didn't do anything different or new from the way the report, but the way the report was written, prosecutors are not supposed to issue reports where they say, well, we can't say this person's innocent, but we're not going to charge them either. That's against the rules of the Justice Department, for the very reason that if you're not going to be in court, then the target of your declarations, the prosecutor's declaration, they can't fight the claims you're making against them. And that's why prosecutors are not supposed to do that. So, you know, I think he failed in his basic handling of this, and he hasn't really been called on it the way he should, except by, frankly, some former Justice Department officials, including me, including Andy McCarthy, and others. The other big thing out of this was, remember, he said if he gets called before Congress, he's not going to say anything other than what's in that report. So Democrats who think they're going to get some kind of big reveal, that he's going to say something that he hasn't said before, or there's some big secret he'll let out if they call him up and have him testify, that's not going to happen.
Yeah. Well, presumably the purpose that they wanted has been served by how he handled himself yesterday on this this one point. And do you anticipate that we'll now see full-on impeachment inquiries and hearings and so on flowing from this?
Well, it's clear to me that the Democratic leadership, like Nancy Pelosi, is very wary of that. They know that there are certain parts of their base that are clamoring for it, but they also know that impeachment is a purely political process. And as the Bill Clinton impeachment showed them, and this lesson is they know this, if a majority of the American people do not believe that a president's actions warrant impeachment, and a political party goes ahead with it anyway, it will hurt them. And I think Nancy Pelosi and others recognize a majority of the American people do not believe that the impeachment process should go forward.
Yeah, well, I'm among them, as I think are you. Hans, very quickly, one other very interesting development in recent days has been the appeal, imploring, I think was the word that John Brennan used to describe it, to those in the, for want of a better term, deep state intelligence apparatus to defy President Trump's directive that they must cooperate with William Barr in investigating the investigators, to put it in the shortest of short forms. Tell us what you make of what he and Jim Clapper, I guess for that matter, have been up to, and what it says about both them and the likely defiance of this presidential directive.
Boy, isn't it shocking that individuals like that were ever entrusted with high up posts inside the government, particularly in a very sensitive area like intelligence gathering. Look, it's amazing to me that so many in the media and others aren't making a bigger deal about this. Look, here's what the president has said. He said, we want disclosure and transparency, something that liberals are constantly pushing for when it comes to government. And that's exactly what the president did. He's given the attorney general the ability to declassify with proper safeguards all of the original documents, communications that helped open up this investigation. We should all be supporting this, because the point of this is to investigate whether or not federal law enforcement and intelligence agencies were used for a partisan political purpose instead of for law enforcement. And I don't care what your political background, what party you're in, you ought to want that kind of investigation go forward, because everyone should agree that federal law enforcement and intelligence capabilities should not be used against fellow Americans for partisan political purposes. And the only way for us to know whether that happened or didn't is for the declassification to go forward and us and the public have full disclosure of all this. So Clapper, frankly, ought to be ashamed of himself for being out and saying things like that, and yet he's not getting taken to task for it like he should.
Yeah. And Hans, again, you've put your finger, of course, on the problem. This is a mortal threat to a functioning democracy or democratic republic like ours, and to the rule of law, if people who engage in that kind of abuse of the security apparatus of this country for partisan purposes get away with it. Do you think these guys will at the end of the day?
Well, William Barr is, if he goes forward with what he says he's going to do, no, they're not going to get away with it, because Barr has been adamant about the fact that he wants an investigation of how all of this started. And that will include looking at the actions that folks inside the swamp, the same ones Brennan and Clapper are talking to, how they acted and what they did.
We have to let you go. Hans Bonspakovsky, thank you, as always, for finding a few minutes for us and for the great work you do at the Heritage Foundation. And come back to us again soon. Next up, we will speak with Stephen Mosier right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, I'm pleased to say, joined by Stephen Mosier. Dr. Mosier has the distinction of having been the first American social scientist to visit mainland China, and not just visit it, but live there for a time, taking stock of what was the nature of the Chinese communist regime and the, well, threat that it posed both to its own people, as it happens, notably through its so-called one-child policy, and more generally, but also to us. Stephen Mosier is the author of A Mother's Ordeal, One Woman's Fight Against China's One-Child Policy, among others, including Hegemon, China's plan to dominate Asia and the world. He writes, well, prolifically on these topics, and I'm very proud to say is, among other things, a member of the new Committee on the Present Danger China, as well as the president of the Population Research Institute, which he founded quite some time ago. Dr. Mosher, it's so good to have you with us. Thank you for the work you've done over such a long period of time on helping the rest of us understand what we're up against in the form of communist China and the party that misrules it. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio.
It's great to be here. This is a topic that we all Americans ought to be thinking and talking about frequently, because China is the threat to American preeminence in the world. And of course, we know a world under Chinese domination would be a much darker place than a world under American leadership.
Amen. I did want to sort of take stock with you. We're having this conversation close by the eve of the 30th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre, which I think for many Americans was a rude reminder of what the nature of the Chinese Communist Party is and what it is capable of doing to its own people, let alone to others. Were you in China at the time? And what are your reminiscences of that period 30 years ago and its abiding relevance today?
Well, the Tiananmen demonstrations, followed by the Tiananmen massacre committed by the butchers of Beijing, led by then paramount leader Deng Xiaoping, was a watershed event, I think, in the history of modern China. I was at the Heritage Foundation in those days. But shortly after the communist regime brutally murdered unarmed students and demonstrators in the main square in downtown Beijing, I went around the world to Hong Kong, Taiwan, France, to interview some of the people who'd escaped from China, who'd survived that massacre and managed to get on the Underground Railroad out of the country. And what they told me, of course, was that the deaths did not just occur in and around Tiananmen Square, that there were lots of uprisings in greater Beijing. There were uprisings in Chengdu, in the interior, and many demonstrations in other cities that were also put down by deadly force. So I've always believed that the number of dead far exceeded 1,000 or two. That was probably closer to 10,000. But it showed to the world, Frank, that this regime was willing to kill massive numbers of people in order to stay in power. Now, that shouldn't have surprised anybody, because that's what communist regimes do, right? The ordinary communist regime, when it gets into power, will kill on average 10 to 15% of the population. That's the percentage we get from Cambodia, from the Soviet Union, and so forth. Now, China, because of the one-child policy, has probably killed a total of 400 million people in forced abortions and purges and the Cultural Revolution in government-caused famines. So it is actually exceeding the standard for communist regimes. It's probably killed off what would have been 30% of the population of China in its various misguided program. So it's safe to say that the Chinese Communist Party is the biggest killing machine in human history.
Wow. Steve Mosher, you have written, among other things recently, about a topic that's very much on a lot of our minds, especially in the midst of this so-called trade war with China. And that is that there is a certain inevitability to China's dominance of the 21st century. And the corollary to that is that we must engage with the Chinese on basically their terms, economically, financially, in terms of our dependence on their supply chains, even in ways that are clearly putting us at considerable risk to the public safety, not least, but also to the national security. Walk us through why it ain't necessarily so that it's the 21st century is going to be China's and we must rely on them in order for us to prosper.
We've heard for decades now that the 21st century belongs to China. That was predicated on the idea that China would be going our way, that China would move in the direction of a free market, would come to respect human rights, and would allow civil society to thrive, including a thriving private sector of the economy. That is not coming true. In fact, China is moving in the other direction. It's moving back towards state planning, the China say openly that private industry is only a temporary phase in China's socialist progress. So what we see in China today is another Soviet Union. The state-owned sector of the economy, which is roughly half of the economy of China, is losing trillions of dollars each year. The Chinese Communist Party is a parasitical organization of 94 million people, which survives by literally sucking the blood of the Chinese people, spending probably $1 trillion a year for its salaries, its offices, its resorts, its foreign trips, and so forth. So those are two big factors holding back China. The only sector of the Chinese economy that really operates according to market principles is the export sector of the economy. That sector is being targeted now by Trump's long overdue tariffs. What we're going to be seeing, I think, is supply chains leaving China, factories leaving China. The Taiwan now has a big program called Return to Taiwan, and several hundred factories that located in China 20, 30 years ago to be reopening factories in Taiwan. And I think you see that all happening all over Asia with companies leaving China, going to the Philippines, India, Vietnam, Mexico, and even back to the United States. What a thing. So the 21st century is not going to belong to China. It would only belong to China if we continued the failed policy of, say, President Obama, who seemed to be more interested in managing the decline of the United States instead of keeping us as the number one power in the world. Fortunately, we have a president now who has a very different policy.
Indeed. Thank God. I feared that it wasn't just managing our decline, it was accelerating our decline under Obama. On this question of China and, you know, sort of the unworkability of its model as it reverts to sort of more traditional sort of communist totalitarian practices politically and economically, one of the things that has enabled it to, you know, prosper is not just the tolerance by the United States government under successive Republican and Democratic administrations, Steve Mosher, of their predatory economic and trade policies, but also our underwriting of their companies, their so-called private sector in particular, but also state-owned enterprises that are now in our capital markets and others throughout the West. To what extent does it seem to you that that's every bit as inadvisable as our sort of tolerating their, predatory trade practices?
Well, we've been financing the Chinese rise for decades now. And it's ultimately very, very foolish of us, not just in a larger strategic sense, but even in a financial sense. Everybody should understand that the numbers that come out of China are always rigged for political purposes. When you hear that the Chinese economy is growing at 6.1% a year, which I think is the latest figure released by the Chinese Communist Party apparatchiks in Beijing, you must understand that that number is intended to placate and convince the Chinese people that things are getting better all the time. I don't think the Chinese economy is growing at anywhere near that number. But it certainly is true that by listing companies on the New York Stock Exchange, that they have gained access to Western capital. By having American investment firms invest in Chinese bonds issued by state-owned companies and other nominally private sector companies in China. I say nominally because there are no real private sector companies in China. Any company with over 50 employees has to have a Communist Party cell. Any company with over 50 employees has to have a member of the Communist Party, usually the head of that Communist Party cell, on their board of directors. Now, if we're at a board meeting and you're the chairman and I'm the head of the Communist Party organization in the company, who really has the last word? So there are only nominally private sector companies in China. No real private sector companies. We have already delisted dozens of Chinese companies from the New York Stock Exchange because the numbers didn't add up. They were basically deceiving Western investors, promising more profits than they actually were. We ought to disengage our economy from China. That should be the ultimate goal here.
Yeah, amen. And I think this is where we will inexorably be forced to go, especially as we learn more and more and more about the dangers of being dependent upon China, whether it's for rare earth minerals or whether it's for flat screens or computer chips or food or medicine for that matter. And all of those are acute vulnerabilities for us at the moment. We appreciate tremendously, Dr. Stephen Mosher, your clarity on the nature of the Chinese Communist Party and what it has in mind for us and the rest of the world, as well as your really quite courageous stand on behalf of the people of China against that monster, and of course, looking out for us as well. Thank you for the work you do, among other places, at the Population Control Institute, and also for your important works, notably Hegemon. It's required reading. Keep up the good work, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. In the meantime, thank you for your membership in our Committee on the Present Danger, China, and we'll look forward to talking with you again in the near future.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're back visiting, as we have the privilege of being able to do just about every week, with a wonderful resource, a man who is both renowned for his expertise in the financial sector as well as his commentaries, notably his essays at Asia Times under his nom de plume, Spengler. He is also the author of How Civilizations Die. He is, of course, David Goldman. It's always good to have you with us, sir. Welcome back.
Frank, it's a privilege. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, I wanted to sort of bounce around with you some of the points that Stephen Mosher made in the previous segment, if I can, David. You follow the markets closely. You're deeply knowledgeable about what's going on in China. He was much less sanguine about the claimed performance of the Chinese market at the moment than, or the Chinese economy, I should say, than the Chinese government would have us believe. I think they're claiming that it's a 6% growth rate thereabouts. He feels that that's simply a function of cooking the books and that it's actually doing less well than that. There was a report that I shared with you from CNBC about the use of diesel fuel in the Chinese economy declining sharply that suggests, in fact, performance is down. I gather you've got some other ideas on the explanation for that, but I'd be interested both in that CNBC report, David, as well as your assessment overall of how the Chinese economy is doing.
Frank, there are a lot of people who use things like satellite imagery or people with hand clickers outside factory parking lots, survey data, to look at the Chinese economy, and all of them believe the Chinese economy is growing at a more or less the same rate it has, but there hasn't been a significant change. So that would be around 6%. That would be organizations like China Beige Book, which is an American organization which does hundreds of interviews and its own surveys, and a number of consulting firms that use the satellite images. So I've seen no evidence of a significant Chinese slowdown from any of the people who do this for a living. I'm not sure where Steve Mosher derives that conclusion.
Well, let me just say, in part, I think it's just a deep suspicion about the veracity of the Chinese in their reporting.
Oh, I don't believe a thing the government says. I look at all of the reports from mainly U.S. and European private sector analysts and try to collate the data. So I agree one shouldn't trust the Chinese government for a second, but there is a wealth of data suggesting that the growth rate has been pretty steady. The interesting thing about China is their rail network's growing at 10% a year. Freight traffic is growing by 10% a year. And they've shifted a lot of their trucks away from diesel to natural gas. So you can explain virtually all of the change in diesel consumption by looking at the shift of freight. Natural gas would be kind of a cherry on the cake on top of that. So, in fact, what we're looking at is China's economy that's becoming much more energy efficient. Remember, the Chinese have one great vulnerability, which is imported oil. If there were a war, the United States certainly could interdict oil shipments. So the Chinese are, as quickly as they can, trying to reduce dependency on imported oil.
Yeah, it's a sensible play on their part for sure. And also pollution, I know, is a consideration as well. Let me ask you about another aspect which is near and dear to your heart, David Goldman, and that is China's corporations have long been penetrating Western capital markets and underwriting their activities, some of which are frankly pretty nefarious, through, you know, the investments of American institutional investors, pension funds, as well as private individuals. One of our colleagues, Roger Robinson, who shared a stage with you in New York at a Committee on the Present Danger event a month or so ago, pointed out that Chinese companies are able to do that because they don't have the same obligation to disclose material risk, for example, or their audits and the like that American corporations in our markets are subjected to. Is that of concern to you from a business point of view, first of all, and again, in terms of its strategic advisability?
The Chinese are moving as quickly as they can to try to make their capital markets more efficient. The reason they need that is because they want the RMB, their currency, to compete with the dollar as a global reserve currency and perhaps eventually replace it. You can't do that without a well-regulated and efficient capital market. You can't have a fiat currency with completely opaque characteristics and get people to keep their deposits in RMB. So they are inviting American banks and foreign banks, and they've already given 100% ownership licenses to Unibank Switzerland and to Allianz Insurance in Germany. That's the parent of PIMCO in the United States. J.P. Morgan is looking for a license. It's sort of a gold rush in the part of the financial sector. So I think we have more to fear from the Chinese becoming more transparent and making their financial markets more efficient as a springboard for competing against us than we have from the old, very opaque and somewhat dodgy accounting that we've had all these years.
Interesting. We'll be watching that opportunity for them to do an end run very closely, David. One other issue that has been discussed a bit lately and that I'm personally quite interested in, and I think you are as well, David, that is the supply chains that we have cultivated over many years now, principally as a result of the Chinese being able to underbid just about everybody else in terms of low labor costs for labor-intensive products. And we find ourselves as a result now, in part of that sort of basic practice, but the larger attitude towards sort of setting aside national security interests in favor of, you know, sort of the global marketplace cost reduction imperatives. Can you talk a little bit about the advisability of our current dependency on China, for example, for electronics, for rare earth minerals, for medicine, for in some cases food even, that could well be used against us in various ways?
Well, the really devastating thing in my view, Frank, is the fact that we now only ship 10% of the world's integrated circuits. We invented the semiconductor industry. We're now a very minor player in terms of actual manufacturing. We had about 25% in 2011, 10% now, probably down to less than 5% in 5 years. And if we can't produce our own silicon, I'm talking about the chips that go into military communications, satellites, the F-35, we don't really have any kind of national security. The basic problem is all the Asian governments subsidize this very capital-intensive form of manufacturing. The latest Taiwan semiconductor fabrication plant for integrated circuits is going to cost around $20 billion. So our companies have decided that they can make more money in software in capital-light investments, and they've left the subsidized Asians to take this over. Koreans, Taiwanese, and of course now increasingly the Chinese. That, in my view, is a catastrophic, potentially catastrophic situation for national security. As you know, I wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal at the end of December calling on the administration to take extreme measures to bring semiconductor fabrication back to the United States. I don't think we can stop Huawei and other companies who are threatening to dominate the high-tech world if we don't have our own products to compete with.
Yeah, I agree. And the imperatives for doing that with respect to Huawei have become increasingly clear. In fact, I was listening to a report of an interview with a Federal Trade Commissioner earlier today who was essentially making the argument, Gregory Starks, who was warning that, you know, we're going to have to not only prevent 5G technology that Huawei has on offer elsewhere from being brought here pursuant to, among other things, President Trump's directive, but also root it out of the rural carriers who have already adopted, if not 5G, 4G, 3G, maybe technology from the Chinese that is fraught, shall we say. Hey, one last question quickly before we have to let you go, David Goldman. Taiwan seems to be increasingly in the crosshairs of the Chinese. They've long, of course, made it known that they intend to reunify the island with the mainland at some point. That point may be at hand, according to some who are watching their military capabilities as well as sort of the more threatening rhetoric and behavior. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, China doesn't want to fight for whatever it thinks it can get for free, and it believes the threat is modern in execution. The threat is 40,000 Chinese Marines, 50,000 mechanized infantry trained for amphibious landing, and several hundred landing craft, as well as a very large submarine fleet, massive amounts of surface-to-ship missiles, and, of course, the Russian S-400 air defense system, which from Chinese land can sweep the skies over Taiwan. So the Chinese think that a massive military threat against Taiwan and the credible threat of an invasion capability is going to keep the Taiwanese in line. The United States has, of course, improved relations recently with the Taiwanese. The question is, to what extent is that symbolic? Do we really want to get into a kinetic situation, in other words, a shooting war with the Chinese and the Straits of Taiwan? I don't think that the military would currently advise the U.S. administration to get into that kind of situation.
Yeah, well, I think they're very reluctant to do it indeed. We have to leave it at that. David, thank you very much for your time today, as well as the expertise you bring to bear week on week at Asia Times, among other places. We'll talk with you again in the near future. Thank you. Next up, we'll speak with Lawrence Sellin about, well, among other things, gas attacks in Syria, by whom, and also what China's up to in South Asia. Watch this space. More on that straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and it's time to take a look at several issues that we've touched on in the past for the purposes of updating on some important and, well, continuing developments with Dr. Colonel Lawrence Sellin, a man who retired after 29 years of distinguished service in the United States Army Reserve, having served, among other places, in Afghanistan and Iraq. He is the author of Restoring the Republic, Arguments for a Second American Revolution. He has been deeply knowledgeable about and skilled in a whole host of issues that are of interest to us, one of which is chemical weapons, something he had specialty in the United States Army, and something that he has raised red flags about in connection with various allegations, some of which have been the subject of not only U.S. government denunciations, but military action, namely claims that the Syrian government, Bashar Assad, had used chemical weapons against assorted rebels and civilians and the like in Syria. There's been some recent news on this subject, and I wanted to double back with Lawrence Sellin and find out what he knew about it and what he could share with us. Lawrence, thank you so much for joining us. It's always great to visit with you. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you, Frank.
So what is the latest on the past attacks? There are reports that they're continuing, by the way, but the past attacks involving gas in Syria by the government.
Well, last year, on April 7th, 2018, the Syrian government was accused of a chemical attack using a sarin nerve agent and chlorine gas on the Syrian rebels in the city called Douma. And as a result, there were 70 fatalities, including women and children. Now, the problem was that the only information coming out of Douma was being supplied by the Syrian rebels and their associates. Nevertheless, at that time, I read all the reports and looked at all the images and videos, and I was frankly skeptical. I saw one video in which I saw an alleged patient who seemed to me was faking the symptoms of nerve agent. And from that, I concluded that there was really insufficient evidence to draw a conclusion. Now, I was quite shocked that a week later, the United States, France, and Britain conducted a major airstrike on Syria based on this, and in retaliation, that is, for the chemical attack. Now, subsequent to that, an organization for the prohibition of chemical weapons went to Douma, took physical, chemical, biological samples, and interviewed the witnesses. In July of last year, they issued an interim report saying that there were no evidence of nerve agents, no evidence of chlorine gas, but there were what are called chlorinated hydrocarbons, which said could be formed when hydrocarbons interact with molecular chlorine. After that, the UN issued their own report saying they thought there was a chemical chlorine gas attack in Douma. And in March of this year, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons issued their final report and said they also thought that it was a chlorine gas attack in Douma, but did not supply any new evidence. Now, the kicker is, Frank, that apparently there were people within the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons that were not satisfied and leaked the engineering report 2 weeks ago. And in that engineering report, they said that they thought it was highly improbable that the chlorine gas canisters were dropped from helicopters, and it was most likely that these canisters were manually placed where they were found. So my conclusion is that this event was staged by the Syrian opposition.
And they would have good reason to want to do that, because the U.S. under President Trump had made known that it would respond to punish the government of Syria if it were found to have engaged in this kind of chemical weapons use again, and did, as you say. And I guess the question occurs, if there are people on the ground in Syria willing to kill their own people to trigger that kind of engagement by the United States and other forces, might this happen again? And what are you hearing, Lawrence Sellin, about further use of chemical weapons in that theater at the moment?
Well, we've known all along, Frank, that the Syrian rebels have had access to chlorine gas and have had access to sarin nerve agent. Now, I don't know whether they were these agents were used on the people in Douma. It could have been that the Syrian government actually attacked Douma with conventional weapons, and these people were perhaps in a cellar altogether, and they were suffering from asphyxiation due to the explosions rather than chemicals. So it's entirely possible that the Syrian rebels saw an opportunity here to fake such an event, a chemical attack by the Syrian government, based on what you just said, that the United States might respond and attack Syria.
Yeah. Well, we'll be watching this closely, as I know will you, Colonel Dr. Sellin. Let me ask you about another area that you've focused on closely and have contributed very helpfully to our consideration of as well, and that is what's going on in South Asia at the moment, specifically the Pakistanis and their involvement with the Taliban. You've written, Lawrence, about the fact that there are anti-Taliban Pashtuns in the so-called tribal areas of Pakistan that are being oppressed by the Pakistani military as part and parcel, I guess, of its very active support for our enemies in Afghanistan, with whom, by the way, we are negotiating at the moment, as you know, behind the back of the Afghan government. Give us sort of a lay of the land as you see it at the moment in all of those areas.
Well, the Pakistani military some years ago went into the tribal areas ostensibly to root out what is called the Pakistani Taliban, who were attacking the Pakistan government and the army. But in the process of doing that in the tribal areas, they antagonized the Pashtun population there and actually oppressed them, and eventually used the Afghan Taliban, which are fighting in Afghanistan, to suppress the people within those Pashtun areas. In other words, use the Afghan Taliban as a sort of paramilitary force within the tribal areas to maintain control. And what has happened, it has built up a lot of resentment among the Pashtuns in the tribal areas. And they've actually formulated civil rights organization called the Pashtun Tahafuz Movement, which is a civil rights movement, nonviolent, within these tribal areas. And they have been actually designated by the Pakistan government as a terrorist organization being supported by outside forces. So this is becoming a powder keg.
Well, the place is a powder keg, I guess. You've also been pointing out, you know, what the Pakistanis are up to with the Chinese, what the Chinese are up to with respect to Afghanistan, the ongoing threats the Pakistan military and its terrorist proxies are posing to India. This is not just a powder keg. This is a nuclear-armed powder keg at that. Do you see China at the moment as being a catalyst for these rising tensions between Pakistan on the one hand and China's longstanding enemy, India?
Well, China is Pakistan's ally. As you know, Pakistan has this antagonistic relationship with India, and China is supporting and has actually fought its own war with India. So what I call the China-Pakistan axis is actually working against India, trying to create economic and military dominance in South Asia at the expense of India. So in a sense, India is under threat by both Pakistan and China.
Well, Lawrence Sellin, thank you very much for joining us today and for really keeping watch on a very important part of the world, South Asia. A cockpit of conflict in the past and quite possibly a very devastating one in the not-too-distant future. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.